I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 166 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
A quick note before we get to our interview. You'll notice a slight difference in sound quality at the very end. Our connection changed slightly, and we just went with it. Also, Tara shared offline that we should all watch her website and her Twitter account for updates on appearances. She hopes there will be a signing in December with some of the show writers. Okay, Outlanders, in this episode of the Outlander podcast, we have a very special guest, a New York Times best-selling author, Tara Bennett, the very author of The Making of Outlander, the series, the official guide to seasons 1 and 2, is joining us here today on the Outlander podcast. Tara, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, I'm honored to be here, guys. Thank you so much for making some time for me and to talk about the book. Both Random House and myself are beyond excited that you guys have said yes to talking about it. So thank you for having me.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, was there ever any doubt? Yes. Oh, my goodness. You say Outlander and we jump. I mean, come on. You know, on our end, we were just thrilled that we were even offered the opportunity. Of course, we would. And if we weren't, we would have run after and said, hey, could we possibly interview?
Oh, thank you. That makes me feel lovely. I appreciate it.
So speaking of the book and a little bit backing up a little bit. So how did you get into writing in general? What's your background? What's your training? How did this start?
Sure. Yeah. I was actually a TV producer on the East Coast for almost 10 years. I went to school for that. And it just so happened at the same time, it was in my early career of television. I worked for basically Comcast. They had started broadband, and they had these little things for Excite and At Home, which was early broadband back in the day, where these kind of like local papers for all these towns that had broadband. And I ended up starting to write in the South Jersey area about film and television, and it was a subsidiary of a little side thing that I did with my job, and I ended up really falling in love with it. And as a producer for almost 10 years, I ended up in 2003 changing careers, so I shifted over to writing full time, and I used to write for a lot of show magazines. So a company called Titan Magazines used to do the Buffy the Vampire Slayer magazine and Angel and Smallville and Charmed and all those kinds of things. And I was very, very fortunate to be able to write for them. Buffy was one of my favorite shows back in the day. And that just evolved in my first book that I participated in with Titan was The Making of Fantastic Four, the one with Michael Chiklis. And I was just a contributor on that one. And then they started a book series for the series 24, and they had asked me if I would be interested in going to set and basically doing books from season 1 all the way up to season 6. And that's what really kind of shifted me over to just magazine writing and online writing to also doing books. And I think the thing that worked out really nicely about being a producer was that I know how television works. You know, I know the behind the scenes and how everybody functions and how everybody works as a team to kind of make this one voice for whatever it is you're producing to come together. So when I go out on sets, I know the questions to ask. I know how all the different departments function, because as a producer, I was either working with those people or hiring them or doing what we needed to make it happen. And so that seems to have, you know, been a little perk of me coming from that world. And then I just really love storytelling, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for the people below the line, you know, the non-actors, as much as I love them too, but all the people that, you know, are just kind of crunching every day, 12 to 14 hour days, to help make these worlds that they're producing come to life. And so the 24 books rolled into 25 books. So luckily I've been able to do about one or two a year. And I moved out to Los Angeles about 2 years ago so that I could be a little closer to the things that I was writing about. And it's been just a really amazing and a journey, and one that I'm super, super grateful for. And Outlander, my cousin actually gave me Diana's signed copy of Voyager back when she was doing the book tour for Voyager. And she bought me Voyager and said, I met the author. I'm completely in love with these books. You need to go get one and two, and here's number three. And so I did, and I fell in love with them. And so when I was covering Outlander just for some of the magazines that I write for, and I know Ron Moore, we worked way back together on covering Battlestar Galactica and Star Trek. And so once I knew he was working on the show, and gratefully that I have a resume and we worked together on several different projects, that I went to Sony and said, hey, if you guys ever decided to do something on Outlander, I'd really, really love the opportunity. And that's, they said yes. So that's the long path to getting to Outlander in particular, but I was a book fan way before. And then I was a huge fan of Ron Moore. So when the chocolate and peanut butter of creativity came together, I was very, very lucky to be able to do this book for them.
I love the fact that your friend bought you the third book and said, go get the first two. And she's like,
I know, right? She's like, yeah. My cousin was broke at the time. We both were. And I'm like, okay, but we're huge readers. But I went, I will go do that, because I trusted her so much. And Denise was, you know, go do it. You're going to love them. And I did. So she knew. So yeah, I immediately, you know, was drooling for Drums of Autumn like everybody else. And, you know, I became part of the Diana, the fandom that was, you know, waiting for every subsequent book afterwards.
How many of the books have you read?
I am up to seven. Seven. I haven't read eight, have them, but an occupational problem with me being as active as I am with my work is that I don't get to read as much as I used to. So it's I have a nice pile of things that I need to catch up with. But I've gone back, and what I did do for this book was go back and read the first three books again, which I had done on several occasions. But when you suddenly have to really start digging into the specifics for questions, it was just great for me to go back and be very aware and cognizant without, you know, the lapse of memory, to be able to remember what they had taken from what book and what had pulled from once, you know, how they put them into different seasons. So, but for me, yeah, I still, which is good for me, is that I still have, I have seven and eight to look forward to, which is great. When I'm also trying to maintain, when a book project comes up and it is part of a series or there's several seasons, I kind of look at them as stay in the lane of where I am, so that I don't get over and ahead of myself, because, you know, I know how they write the series. And so they are also trying to stay relatively close and not too far ahead. They have two people on staff that have read everything all the way through, so that they can come back and go, no, no, no. We can't write it that way, because, you know, there'll be a problem. There'll be an issue with what Diana brings up in the future. But they really like to have, especially with the new staff and such, stay reading where they are. And then they have someone making sure that they are not going to screw something up in terms of continuity for the series by not knowing what's coming down the line. So I kind of do that. I figure doing that as well allows me to just, you know, kind of be in the headspace of where the show writers are, and to not also, you know, go too far. There's always the temptation to go, well, you know, but how are you working on such and such in the future? And I wouldn't include that in the book anyway, because I don't want to spoil people when they're reading this. Stay with seasons one and two. So therefore, it might be a cruel side conversation or something that, you know, hopefully I can, you know, add later on down the pike, but it's better for me to not get too deep in the weeds where it, the experience of reading the book that I wrote would in any kind of way spoil anybody that had not gotten to those places in the books as well. So.
So you, in a fashion, want to stay much like the writers, the set writers, the show writers, and be able to immerse yourself in what, well, for one and two, and what was going on there. And then for coming seasons, what will happen there? And so then books three and four. So my question is, if given the opportunity to come back, would you do a repeat for the next two seasons? Or is it something that after your experience doing a combined one and two that you'd want to split out into season three, season four, and going on into the future?
It really depends on how we do as a book. Which has been lovely so far is that we've done great, which is really fantastic. And my goal whenever I get assigned a book is to basically not get in anybody's way, because I'm so respectful of what the process is to make a show or a film. I know how difficult it is to, you know, even if when they have downtime in between scenes, they're still working on where their headspace needs to be for the next scene. Maybe then it might need to be, you know, kind of crunching new lines or things that might be happening. So if I'm present and I'm pulling people out of the process, that's really difficult. And so what I end up doing is whatever the production needs. So if they say to me, you know, hey, you know, one and two was so wonderful that we could do those both together because obviously we got picked up for a second season. Oftentimes with these kinds of books too, they like to wait until a second season to see, you know, first season might be a slow burn, obviously not with Outlander. It might be that a show needs 2 years to get its fandom and to also find its footing creatively. So if a book comes out for a new series, it's usually going to encapsulate the first two seasons. But it is, you know, really kind of open-ended afterwards as to do we want to get out a third book relatively soon to when the end of season three for Starz would air, you know, so that fans could come off of the experience watching, you know, however the whole season that they're going to do and then immediately get a book, or Sony and the show will have to make a decision as to, okay, well, you know what, we'd rather these kind of work in two volumes. I, you know, recommend based on what works for the production, but I can do either, you know, and it's really, I think, going to be, let's see how this book goes with the first two seasons and let's see how production is going. And then I'd love to do more books on this. I hope, you know, that I get the opportunity to do it. But I don't have as much of a say as that, aside from raising my hand and jumping up and down going, please, if you'd like to do it, I'd love to do another one. But I'm really at the mercy then of what everybody internally decides is the best thing to do for a third or a third and fourth volume that might work, you know, in tandem like this one does.
So what was your goal with this book? Obviously to show behind the scenes of the two seasons, but how did you plan or want to cover the actors, producers, sets, costume, and other behind the scenes people? What at the outset was your kind of plan of attack?
That's a great question, because I take the angle of a book really seriously. I'm a fan. I buy these books as well. With the dawn of the internet, you can get a lot of great stuff on a favorite show or a movie. You know, there's no shortage of people doing, you know, postmortem interviews, recaps, interviews with the stars and the actors. And so I'm really cognizant of going, you know, if someone's going to spend anywhere from, you know, $20 to $50 on a book that I'm going to make, I want to make sure that it's something that's going to be different and special and not feel like it's some kind of rehash of stuff that you could have read online. I'm really, for me to have my name on something, I fight really hard to make sure that it's worth your dollar. You know, at the end of the day, cash grabs, we've all seen them, you know, and I get really upset if I buy something and it's all pictures and no words, or, you know, it just feels like it's something that was kind of thrown together. And so when they asked me if I said, yes, you can do the book, I immediately sat down with my editor, Ann Sperry, who's really wonderful and works with Diana on her fiction books. I said, you know, I can go and see an episode summary somewhere else. I can, you know, see a ton of EP interviews, you know, the executive producer interviews, and certainly Kat and Sam have tons of interviews. But I think what really honors the entire show is to put different voices, you know, and not just do the, like, here's who's in this episode and here's what they do. The creative vision really for every episode is going to be the writer, Ron, and the director. You know, they all have a huge influence on what that final episode is going to look like. And I said, I think really every episode should be the voice of the writer and the voice of the director. You, one, have the person that was in the room with everybody breaking it. So they're going to have all of the stories about why something was put in, why something was left out, what their interpretation was, when they added new material, why they did it. And then you've got on location in Scotland, the director who's dealing with all of the day to day. So, you know, being on a location, making a set that needs to reflect something, capturing the intimacy of the moment with the actors and how they went about doing that. And certainly this show has tons of episodes where it's really, really difficult moments to get these actors through. And I felt like both of those perspectives were the ones that would really allow a reader the insight. And this fandom is so wonderful in terms of wanting to know. You know, some, you know, you watch an NCIS and it's throwaway television. With serialized television, and especially with Diana's World and Outlander, this fandom really wants to know, how has that adaptation process worked? And what are the choices? And why have you done what you've done from all of the creative people? And so that was my real goal. And I think once they understood that that's what I wanted to do, they agreed with it. And then they gave me access to all of the directors and the writers and their time, which is really wonderful, especially those that aren't working on the show now. You know, some season one directors were working on other projects or films. You know, season two directors, I was able to get people that were, you know, had breaks or were off of a block and I could talk to them. But everybody made themselves available. And I was able to really get some really interesting things. And then once I was able to interview all of the actors, I really wanted to try to ask them things that were not necessarily touched upon, or just ask it in a different way. You know, they get asked a lot of the same things over and over again. So I really wanted to dig in on certain moments that I knew the fandom really found were important, or just me as a watcher of the show found to be very, very compelling. And then the idea from that was everybody would get their own section, but then everything that was left over that was pertinent to an episode, we would desperately try to get into each of those episodes so that it was almost like boxed out commentaries from those actors, augmenting what the director and what the writer had done. And, you know, books are, I love them. I love doing them. I've got plenty of them on my shelves. But, you know, we have a finite number of pages. So that's the only disappointment in a book. You have to also figure out how much can we include, what makes it a reasonable price point for everybody that might buy it. And so we kind of shift and work out what sections to keep, how many pages can belong to episodes or actors. And then that kind of gets shaved down in the drafting process. And, you know, we just desperately try to keep everything that's feels like it would be new or somebody's perspective that you haven't gotten that the mainstream press doesn't, you know, kind of dig down into. So, you know, transportation, locations, you know, people doing armory, you know, maybe a deeper conversation with Terry about certain aspects of some of the costumes that were done, Gary and his set decorator about, you know, what was a challenging element in a certain location. And you know, online has a certain readership that it's trying to get, books can go somewhere deeper. And that's really what my whole goal with this whole project was, to try to go deeper as much as we possibly could.
Since the book covered two seasons and you said it, that's not unusual when you work on this type of book, they like to wait sometimes for two seasons to be done or to at least be approved. What was your idea in going forward, knowing you were going to be covering all the stuff you just discussed in two seasons worth of episodes, two seasons worth of commentaries, and two seasons worth of new actors? Is it just a process, as you said, of working with your editor kind of in that plan of attack? Or was there something that you felt drawn to maybe in season two that you wanted to highlight something since you'd already done so much with certain people or certain things in season one? How did you balance seasons one and two coverage?
Yeah, it's a really good question, too. You know, once Anne and I had worked out what I had suggested, she gave me how many pages we have, and we do something called a flat plan, which basically breaks down every page visually in front of us, almost a flow chart. And we appropriated, you know, what we thought was appropriate for how many pages for episodes, how many for cast, for supporting cast, for guest cast that would be highlighted in especially in season two. You know, we got a lot of actors like Stanley and Lewis and And even Sophie and Richard at the end of the season that allowed, you know, us to be able to have a section for them, but they maybe were not in it as much that would, you know, give them the pages that we'd have for, you know, standard cast on the show. So we appropriated all of that. Once that was worked out and we got information on access to everybody that wanted to participate and that could participate based on their schedules, I was kind of left alone then. You know, Anne just said, you know, aside from I'd ask her a question here and there and say, you know, I think this is an important moment. She trusted me, which is great, to be able to chase the things that I thought were interesting. And my process is I'm a fan first. So I just have questions. You know, I'll have my questions of wanting to know the choices, why they did what they did. Of course, as I said, I read the books 1 and 2 over again. So in my head, I was very clear on what had been borrowed from one and or reappropriated for another season, dialogue that might have been changed up, moments that choices for changes. And then I also go online and I look and see what the conversations are amongst fans to see what they post-episode were saying to a writer of an episode, what comments might have been after an interview with somebody about something for an episode. And if I felt like something was being discussed or hadn't been addressed, that fans would say, I put that on my target. You know, I that was a question for me to ask because luckily someone else in the mainstream media didn't answer it. And it's my opportunity to also make a value for the book to go, okay, well, this was important. So let me see if I can ask it in the book. And that's really, you know, I kind of just then dig down into every episode. I make extensive notes for my rewatch of the series, all kinds of little points just about costuming, changes in dialogue, where they set things. And then from that, every time I went to interview somebody, I would just dig down into every one. Now, you know, some of them, I had to do 2 interviews. Sometimes I would talk to somebody for, you know, close to an hour or two. To get through all of the material. And, you know, then, you know, when there were some people that weren't that involved or I knew that we weren't going to be digging into great specifics with them, but doing an overview, per se, of what they do on the show, it was a little less of having to drill down into all those really deep specifics. But for every person I talked to, I absolutely had moments that, you know, in my notes when I watched an episode, I went, you know, make sure to ask so-and-so that or make sure if there's an opportunity to ask that and, you know, get an opinion about why or how well it worked out for them or what they thought about it in the final product. And that system worked out really well. I feel like, you know, I mean, I did 70 interviews for this book and, you know, whether it was multiples with one person, all in all, it was 70. And it was an average of an hour conversation with every person. So I had a lot of material, which is really wonderful. And tried again to distill, or if people answered a question about a topic and it was similar, try to find the voice who talked about it in a way that was different or had a different perspective on it and use that person's commentary to address a question that anybody, myself, a fan, somebody else wanted answered that would highlight it in a way that was different from maybe what we've heard before or was addressed from a certain perspective. And now here's a different perspective on that topic.
As you say, there are many, multiple little character pop-outs where not just you have the larger interviews or the larger sections on Jamie and Claire and Frank and BJR with Tobias Menzies, of course, but you have smaller ones like with Richard Rankin and Sophie Skelton and Andrew Gower and Romain Baru, you know, Claudel Fergus. So one of the things that I didn't see was Dominique Pignon. Was that something that just what you weren't able to work out?
Yeah, sometimes, you know, especially in the situation schedules, Dominique is a incredibly, incredibly honored and legendary actor in France. That man works all the time. And so he is not available. He was not available because of other projects. And, you know, that's always the case with these books is that you try as hard as possible. Some people are also very press shy. They do not like doing interviews, you know, and we never want to impose ourselves and say, you know, well, the fans want it. You need to do it. You know, everybody, we do not try to twist arms. And so if somebody says, I prefer not to, my schedule doesn't work with it, that's the reason why you don't see somebody in a book. We, you know, we try to be as exhaustive as possible and You know, even with Lionel Luthinger, who was the king, he wanted to do it in French. And then one of my best friends speaks French. So I did a conference call with him where I asked the question. My friend translated the question in French. He answered in French, and then my friend translated it for me afterwards. So, you know, whatever I could do to do an interview in the way that made them most comfortable, I tried to make that happen for them. So, yeah, so I'm sad that I didn't get to talk to some of the people, you know, that are key to the show, but it's always their call as to whether or not they participated.
Well, as you said, it is an exhaustive book. I mean, you can tell that good amount of time and research, and I mean, it appears exhaustive, just the number of people that are highlighted. And I know that there are my guess is that there are people that you spoke with who aren't even mentioned by name, right? Just to be able to get that information.
I tried to, you know, there were a couple, when we had to start whittling down for page count, there were a couple people that we did talk to that we couldn't find a place to make a full section for them, especially the accent coaches, some of the people that were helping with translations and things like that. I did talk to them. We couldn't find a space to do a full section on them, but I made sure then that they were mentioned, especially if an actor said, you know, they were incredibly important for me with the Gaelic, or they were really important for me understanding how the French needed to sound. I mentioned them via their interview. So there's a shout out to them, even if they don't get a space. It's always a difficult part of kind of trying again to make something as expansive as these kinds of books we'd like them to be, to whittle them down to something that's a price point that as a fan, you don't go, I'd love to have it, but I can't afford it. So, you know, we always try to figure out and prioritize in a really harsh way, you know, where all of us would love to have a 500 page book where everybody got, you know, 4 pages to talk about what they do on the show, which, you know, in a perfect world we'd be able to do, but in a real world where something needs to be on a shelf and needs to be, you know, again, sold at a price point that everybody feels like that's fair. Yeah, that's worth my money. That's always where the hard decisions need to be made. But again, I tried very, very hard to make sure that if a person was not given space exclusively to them, they were mentioned so that the family of everybody that works on this show let everybody know how important everybody else's work is to their work as much as I possibly could.
Are there any things that maybe didn't get included in this book that you have saved?
Sure.
For perhaps
oh yeah.
A future
I mean,
book?
If you saw my transcripts, you'd see the official guide part 2 plan B book, with plenty of other material. It's so hard. You know, I go through and, I just start digging out the stuff that feels interesting in my first pass. And then that's, you know, hideously long. And then I go, okay, well, who's spoken about this? And who says it, like I said, in a way that feels like somebody's coming at it in a different way. Okay, so then I'll color code. Okay, well, I'm going to leave that part out because somebody else talked about it. And then that helps whittle it down. And then it's really, okay, this was a great moment. And then this was a great moment. But I have to make the horrible decision. And my editor, you know, takes a look at it. Now that's where I'll go back with Anne and go, okay, well, we have these 2 sections. You know, this was a great moment. And then this was a great moment. Which one do you think the majority of fans, you know, we always have to think that way too, would really want to know that, you know, this might be a tidbit that a smaller piece of the fandom might go, ugh, I wish that was included, but I'd be really mad if you didn't include that other piece. And that's, you know, that's the attrition. We start kind of going, okay, and we make a decision because she's obviously a huge fan. She works with Diana, so she knows what's important and what she hears in feedback from fans. And, you know, I'm a fan. And then I also am looking to see what other fans are trying to say. I have, several close friends, including my own mom, who was watching the show, and I, you know, grill them after episodes. You know, I'd go, well, what did you like? What would you want to know more about? You know, and they'd tell me, and I'd use that also as a place to keep me in alignment with what the fandom is interested in. And those, all of those things together kind of help snip everything down to a place. But yeah, if you could just sit and look at all of my transcripts, you would see a whole lot of other material, which I do hope to repurpose in some kind of ways, add to things that are coming in the future, or, you know, just be able to include in sections that would augment or be able to fill out some things that if I'm lucky enough to be able to do other books, fill out those sections.
What was your biggest Sophie's Choice cut?
Oh, goodness. That's rough. You know, we had a much bigger section on Bear McCreary, and we had to cut because we went really deeply into what he was doing with the theme and about how he changed that basically for every single episode, and talking about the cues and the history of him coming to it. And I, you know, we basically had a whole other section where Bear just talked about how he went about doing the score with his collaborators and things like that. And that one killed me, though. We had to let that one go. So yeah, I'm hoping that.
That one kills me.
I know,
too,
it's brutal, right?
I'm a music major, a classical vocalist. I've had the opportunity and the good fortune to interview him, I believe, 3 times. And I just, you know, and I was not a composition major. That's not my forte at all as a performance major. However, having that kind of similar background, having gone through the process of music school for 4 years, oh my gosh, every time I talk to him, it's just like, I geek out every time. So that kills me too. Oh,
he's such a great talk, you know, like he has that wonderful gift of being able to translate what he does, the complexity of what he does, into a language that we all can understand, you know, and that is a really fun conversation because you don't feel like he's talking nuts and bolts and you're going, I don't get it. He talks about in a way where you really understand his passion and his choices. And so, yeah, I'm hoping that if we, again, get the gift of being able to continue on with these and I'm associated with it, that I can take a lot of that material and just, you know, weave it into a new interview where we would be able to dig into a little bit of his process a little bit more.
So you discussed your approach to the making of Outlander. Was it in any way different from how you have approached your other books that also are kind of behind the scenes?
Yeah, you know, everyone is a different animal. The culture of every show is different. You know, I, again, try to leave a very small imprint in terms of impacting, you know, their job is the show. And this is an ancillary project that I try to not make a headache. You know, I mean, they've got a billion different things that they have to do in the day. And making time to talk to me, I try to make a fun experience. You know, you don't want anybody to go like, I gotta get on the phone with Tara. You know, that's, you know, no, I don't want that. I want them to feel like this is going to be a fun opportunity to really highlight what they're bringing to the show. So I learned the culture of the show by talking to the executive producers early on, making sure, you know, that they let me know the things that are important to them, that I make that important to me. I always feel like I'm a steward of the show. That explanation is to provide insight into a show, to in no way denigrate any, you know, Diana's work or anybody on the show, to minimize what anybody does, to elevate everything. It's just really to allow people to get a shine of light on what everybody does day to day that really is so impactful to making everything happen. And so I think that when I worked with this show, one of the things that I wasn't able to do that I do on a lot of the books or the projects, films and TV show stuff that I do on is I usually go to the set. And what had happened with this book was that it took a little while longer than expected in the contractual part of it, which, you know, it's just waiting for business to happen. So what happened was the contract for the book didn't actually come to me until the very end of last year. So December of 2015, which the show was on hiatus for the holidays. And they did want me to head out to Scotland in either mid-January when the show came back into production for its last 2 blocks or for February. And they always knew that they were going to do their last week of work at the very end of February. Now, because I've done so many of these and because, again, I don't want to be in a position on a show, I knew that was going to probably be very problematic to try to, one, go out to Scotland in the dead of winter when the show is in its final 6 weeks of production, when I'm, you know, being told by Wendy Kidd, who is was my coordinator with the interviews, who works in Scotland, you know, that they're in knee-deep mud and that they've had to not have days of production because the weather's been so bad, that, you know, that everything's shifting because they've, you know, had to go into a studio day unexpectedly one day because the, you know, their environment that they were going to go to was terrible. And I started to get the writing on the wall where, in the best case scenario, of course, I would have loved to have gone out there, but, you know, imagine yourself as a person, you know, doing what my job is and you're going out to Scotland and let's say, you know, you're on location and it's a terrible day and they literally have to be in the moment of when an AD says to them, okay, we've got 5 minutes to shoot because we've got a window and it stopped raining and we can do this. And I'm sitting there going, hey, can you talk about episode 1.7? And in this moment, and, you know, their brain is not there. You know, it is the worst possible timing for me to be imposing on their job when the environment itself is already making things pretty difficult for everybody involved. And I just realized around the beginning of February, it would be far better for me to just do phone interviews with everybody on this one, because me being there was not going to make anybody's lives better. So what then we did was we just immediately started doing interviews with everybody that had already locked, you know, prior season one directors that had moved on to other things, any actor that was not participating in this block of shooting, go to them, and then really just start a cycle of basically doing for me. I was doing from February until all the way through April, anywhere from 5 to 7 interviews a day. Me starting, because I live in Los Angeles, at 6, 7 in the morning, immediately doing interview after interview after interview, one after the other based on everybody's schedules. You know, I just made myself completely amenable and available to their needs, because their windows were most important. And then I just made myself ready, you know, for whoever needed to talk, whoever had an opportunity. You know, Tobias had moved on to working on a play. So I had to do my interview with him when he was, before he'd do his evening shows. So it was, everything was the kind of crazy marbles of trying to collect all the marbles and put them back in the bag, and the bag being just me getting the interview so I could get the book done.
What was it like as an Outlander fan previous to coming to this project? Was it, again, I'm going to compare it, asking you to compare it to other books that are similar. Has your experience as an Outlander fan approaching this project been different than your experience being the author of, say, another project that's a behind-the-scenes book of something that maybe wasn't based on books, or that's something that you weren't necessarily particularly a fan of already?
You know, I always feel the weight of responsibility with shows that have a tremendous fandom. Here's the thing. I try to orient myself towards projects that I'm really passionate about. And if I'm lucky enough to get that project, I feel like I'm a steward of the fandom, representing them and then representing the show. And so I take it super duper seriously that I'm getting both sides serviced as well as possible. And Outlander was intimidating, only in that this fandom has been around for 25 years. The show hasn't, you know, the show is new. But the show brings with it 25 years of fandom and expectations. And, you know, a lot of the fandom, too, wants to, you know, they're questioning, why did, you know, Ron make that decision, or why did Ron and Meryl decide to do it this way? And, you know, you want to try to bridge the gap between what someone's been imagining this show to be for, you know, somewhere between 1 to 25 years, depending on how long you've been with the fandom, versus the realities of what it takes to make a television show and the creative choices that have to be made, the compromises, the things that work better for a book versus what works better when you have to portray it. And because I know both of those worlds, I was really important for me to try to bridge the gap as much as I possibly could in explaining to a fandom, here's why they tried to do what they did, in the voice of the people that made that choice. Not me going, here, you need to understand it this way. In me trying to target the voice that will explain that the best way possible. But then also, you know, just making sure that the fandom feels like the things that were important to them are going to be represented. So I feel like there was a lot of stress to make sure that I wasn't coming off as a softballer. You know, I don't need to make a book where everybody reads and goes, yeah, been there, done that, Tara. Thanks a lot. No insight at all. You know, so I put a lot of stress on my own shoulders to make sure that, you know, the answer still may not be the answer that a fan wants, but at least I gave them an answer. You know, I think that was the thing that I was really trying to do as much as I possibly could in a lot of places where there may have been controversy in terms of changes or interpretation. It's not my job at the end of the day with this book for someone to go, oh, I get it, I'm a convert. But I'd like you to at least have an answer so that, you know, you get that the show was thinking about the things that maybe you didn't think they were thinking about, or there's an explanation for why they made the choices they did in the adaptation process. But then also to really respect, hopefully, all of the thought that was put into everything that they've done, and to also honoring, you know, what Diana has created and continues to create to today, so that there's the two sides of the coin in terms of, you know, the book lovers versus the TV lovers, those that have never read the book. My mom's an example of that. She's never read the book, so she's coming at it just as a fan watching the TV show. So that, you know, she's reading it and not feeling like the companion guide is overly leaning, you know, on just the book fans too. Cause you know, she's going to go, I don't know what you're talking about with that stuff. I didn't read any of that narrative to know. So she's looking at it like, I just want to know the choices that they made for the show itself as a show. So that's where I think a lot of the weight on this book for me to be able to try to create a cohesion and to feel that what was in it felt valuable to service both ends of that was made this distinctive, you know, with a show like Fringe, where we did an in-world book that was in a character of the show. That one was trying to make sure that we're capturing a voice, you know, that actually tangibly lives inside of that show. And, you know, with other behind the scenes books, it's, you know, maybe if it's an art book that I'm doing with the animators for, you know, the Ice Age films, it's really understanding the process of development, you know, over 5 movies for that. So that as somebody that might be coming to it from an artistic standpoint and someone that's fascinated in the evolution of design and concept and how a character may have started looking like something and then looked like something else, that I'm telling that story. So each one is its own thing. But for Outlanders, I feel for me, it was really trying to service 2 fandoms that, you know, equally deserved a book that was going to feel like it was fulfilling and answering questions and bridging the gap between the 2 entities.
Did you actually have carte blanche regarding access to people in production for prepping for the book?
Pretty much. You know, what we did was we asked Robin Harney, who works for Sony PR for the show, and then Wendy Kidd, who was the coordinator in Scotland. We had a wish list. Wish list went out to them, and then they determined through the representation of everybody or through that person directly, especially with those that were that, you know, are the crew members. You know, they don't have representation. It's just, hey, do you want to do this? And then they go, yeah. It's far more casual. But we went through all the processes of saying, if you could be available, would you want to do this? And then once we got the yeses, then it was me just working with coordinating either with someone's representation, whether it was coordinating with Wendy saying, you know, so-and-so is not on set today. They can do the interview at this time. And then just throwing me on the phone with them. It was very organic in terms of sometimes, you know, availabilities and just saying, hey, could you do it now? Yes. Okay. All right. And make myself, you know, wipe off my calendar really quickly and just get on the phone with somebody because they had a window. And so, yeah. So then when it came to me getting on the phone and talking to any person, it was just me. You know, it was, you know, when I do interviews for magazines or for online, sometimes a publicist will sit on the line with me, you know, just because, especially when something's very spoilery, they get very twitchy and scared that whoever I'm talking to is going to say something that they shouldn't. And then the voice of God comes in and goes, no, we're not answering that. with all of these phone calls, no, it was just me and them. And we would just, we'd chat, you know, we just, where the conversation went, it would go. Sometimes, you know, some tangential things that, you know, I didn't even have in my notes, something that someone would say something and I go, whoa, I didn't know that. Let's follow that and talk about, you know, how that ended up happening. It might have been a cool story about a workaround that they had to do or just some interesting things, you know, that would come out of just a comment that someone would make. But yeah, I was very grateful and to be able to just, you know, have those conversations and just they were conversations between me and the person.
It sounds like most of your interviews for this book were done because of availability and the timing and you not going there, we're done via telephone. Is that your preferred method of interview?
It depends. I actually did all the writers in the writer's room because the writers are here in California. So I just went to their offices and that was great. You know, I had lunch with Tony Grafia, you know, sat around with Ira Bear, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So the writers and I really had really nice face-to-face interviews, except for Matt and Meryl, because they're mostly in Scotland. So really with them, it was getting them when they had windows of opportunity to chat. But I've interviewed Sam and Katrina and I would say a good chunk of the actors before I was working on the book project because I was covering it for magazines. It was my show to cover for SFX magazine. I was covering it for Sci-Fi magazine, a couple online outlets. So junkets or Comic-Cons or things like that, you know, that's where I'd met them for the first time and they were lovely. But it really depends. You know, some people will say, oh, it's, you know, it's, you know, even family members going like, well, did you phone interview somebody or did you face to face it? Like, there's some kind of like, well, it doesn't really count unless you met them face to face. You know, sometimes when you are in a junket situation where you only get an actor for a short period of time, I'd rather be on the phone with them because it's usually more amenable to their schedule and they're more relaxed and they aren't answering the same thing over and over again. You know, a lot of these actors that are asked to do press days are asked to do, you know, 15, 20, 30 interviews in a day. If I'm given a slot with that, one, I'm getting a really short period of time. And then I'm also getting them when they're really tired, you know, and that they've already said something or a variation of something over and over and over again. So a phone interview to me is an opportunity to just have like a fun conversation. And then to also get them when they may not have been overly worked through the answers. And, you know, sometimes I would provide some questions ahead of time so that the actors can think about it, you know, because everything becomes a blur and the show is, as everybody knows, you know, shot in blocks. So you aren't necessarily shooting everything in an order that even makes sense to them to delineate, you know, what episode that was from or what I was doing with that episode. So if I gave them some opportunities to kind of mull over a question and like rattle their own brains and go, oh yeah, okay, then that's better. I get better material and I get material that allows them to not go, oh, I'm going to have to think about that because they're tired or they can't remember it because they haven't thought about it in quite some time. So, you know, for this instance, I think it really worked out well. And like I said, so many of these conversations ended up going well beyond an hour, which is not what I would get in any situation unless I was doing a cover story for a magazine with anybody else. You know, maybe if I got Sam or Kate for a cover of a magazine, they'd give me a couple hours on a day to go and interact with them for a while. But otherwise, I wouldn't get them for that period of time for almost anything. So it really, the phone calls actually really worked out.
Who was your favorite interview?
Oh, that's, you know, it's really hard to say. And I'm not saying it to protect anybody. I'm saying that I had a lot of really cool in conversations. Met Nussin was wonderful. The director who did a lot of the blocks in France, he really had some really wonderful insight. I feel like Anna Forrester was really a wonderful interview as well. She really gave me insight into the parallels and the visual choices that she made that carried through, you know, from the wedding all the way to the Wentworth episodes. That was unexpected in terms of her thoughts. Both of them also provided me storyboards, which legally we weren't allowed in this round to put into this book, but I got to see their process of how they made their choices and blocking from what their initial thoughts were to how it came out on the screen. But then, you know, Ron was really, really wonderful. Meryl really gave me this insight as to somebody that had been in love with these books for so long and the process of really being able to finally make this thing that had been on her shelf for quite some time as a dream project. I think Gary was a really wonderful interview. He was so warm and really lovely talking about Colm and him as a character. And then, you know, Sam and Kate, they're just really lovely. And they took the project very seriously. And I think, you know, that I was coming to it from a place that wasn't, you know, kind of flippant or shallow or, you know, asking things that they get asked over and over again and being able to really dig into some scenes and their motivation for why they made Jamie or Claire react the way they did. I think I was really, really wonderful to hear them really think about some of the questions and how seriously they really addressed those things. And I think it was fun for them to really be asked some things that maybe they don't get asked in other arenas. And I just felt very grateful that I was the person that they told some of those things to.
Okay, so Tara, as we wind down this interview, what were some of the joys of the process?
Honestly, it was just really getting to know everybody and to really understand the creative process on the show, how they operate. They really are lovely, lovely people, and they were very generous with their time. You know, I'm a huge fan of Ron's work, and getting to know Meryl, you know, who I knew worked on his other shows but really has not been in a kind of voice capacity to talk about the show. So to be able to get to know her, to really talk to the writers, who I respect very much. I'm also an adjunct professor at Rowan University in New Jersey, and I teach writing for television. And so being able to really kind of nerd out with them was really, really, really wonderful to understand their process, what move them deeply, what they really wanted to get right in terms of adaptation, because the source material was so very deeply important to them. Getting to talk to Diana, you know, please, I mean, hello, that's amazing. So to be able to really talk to the woman whose books I've loved for years and years and years, and she's such a fun woman, and she's, you know, so forthright, and being able to really, you know, just talk about what's been different for her, you know, writing an episode of a TV series based on her books and the kind of surreal and kind of strange nature of that, and really getting immersed in a television show, which has not been her world, was really fun, you know, to get her perspective on that. So they're really, really talented actors. And so being able to get their stories and be able to, you know, dive into their process a little bit is all of it. You know, every single interview had something that was new for me. And I just really appreciated how generous they were with their time.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Tara, for being with us here today and speaking so candidly and at such length and being so gracious to answer pretty much any question we had for you. Could you tell us what you can talk about? What are some of your upcoming projects?
Well, first, thank you both. You guys are really great interviewers, and it's really nice to talk to other fans, and I really appreciate, you know, you digging into what the process is. It's, your writing is such a lonely little process, and, you know, you hope you're doing right by the fans, and so it's really just lovely to hear other fans of Outlander and just have a really fun discussion about the process, so thank you for that. And then the next thing I have coming out is with my co-writer, Paul Terry. We did the 30th anniversary of Big Trouble in Little China, which was a movie that we both loved, and we got to work with John Carpenter and Kurt Russell and Kim Cattrall and everybody that appeared in that movie, and that was a real labor of love for us too. Hopefully that will be out. We just got the okay from all the legal aspects of it on Friday, so it goes to print this week, and we're hoping it'll be out the first or second week of December. So
I mean, I was really excited about this Outlander making of, but now I kind of really want the Big Trouble Little China book, because
that was such 80s children.
I know. It was the greatest. So we got to go into the archives. We got to go into the bowels of Fox and open up blueprints that hadn't been opened in 30 years and get to put them in the book and, you know, talk to all the actors that, you know, they just, it's a seminal, you know, you could think it's goofy, but honestly, it's such a fun movie. It's a precursor sort of like, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy, and the tone of those kinds of movies that we're watching today is, you know, really, you can see the DNA of that back, you know, 30 years ago with what they were doing with that movie. And so it was such a complete and utter joy to be able to, you know, really honor a movie that kind of for a while just got shoved into this kind of weird little stepkid, you know, cult status, and to be able to really bring all aspects of it to light, and even culturally what it means to people today. We're super duper excited about the making of that and the art of both of those will be coming out hopefully in December. And then from that, I'm just doing an animation art book for the next year. I can't announce it yet, but it's with a company and a group of animators that if you look at my resume, I work with quite a lot. And then we, you know, just we try to pitch things, but we're never sure always what's going to come down the pike. But other than that, I write for Blaster.com as a contributing editor, and I write for SFX magazine and Sci-Fi magazine, and believe it or not, The Walking Dead magazine. I'm the lead writer for them as well. So those are the nerdy things that I do day to day between books.
So what you're saying is you absolutely have no work at all.
I never can say that. I never can say that. You gotta hustle to be a writer nowadays. So I would like to keep myself as diversified as possible between teaching and writing and all that kind of good stuff. So that you know, I am so lucky to be able to write about what I write about and to be able to do what I do. And I never complain. So it's a good thing.
Now, Tara, with Random House especially, and knowing Outlander, the Outlander fans, the books, all of that, is there going to be by chance any tour coming up?
There, you know, usually there isn't for books now, unless you're a huge celebrity, and that I am not. So I'm very grateful to be able to do a signing with Diana in Scottsdale, Arizona at Poison Pen, which is her home independent bookstore, and that will be on the 10th of November. We're actually really excited that we've actually expanded to the Hilton Resort, which is in Scottsdale, because so many people have said that they want to show up.
A huge thank you again to author Tara Bennett, and also Random House for helping make this interview possible. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.
Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/outlanderpod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at @outlanderpod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/outlanderpod, or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.